You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Rose Arce. Leonard Lopate is on vacation. We're not. So here we are on WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. There was a time, if you can think that far back, when there was no bridge between Brooklyn and Manhattan, and Manhattan was just this island out there. Emily Barton's second novel, Brookland, takes a look at life across that East River in the early days of the Republic, and one woman's dream to build a bridge across the river. It's just out from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. I'm pleased to welcome Emily Barton to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So where does Brookland come from? Because it's Brookland, it's not Brooklyn, right?
Yeah, Brookland is actually one of the names by which Brooklyn was called during the period. It was also still called Brooklyn in the Dutch pronunciation, but Brookland is one name people used.
Why name it that? Is that just a thing to kind of bring people psychologically back to the time?
For me, it was certainly that. I like the way it sounds, and I wanted to differentiate it from Brooklyn the way we know it. Brooklyn at that time was really still just a farming community with a few manufacturing interests, so I wanted it to sound different.
Now, as I read through your book, I kept getting this funny feeling like I was reading something that was actually written back then, which is, I guess, what you wanted to achieve. And I kept asking myself, well, how does she do that?
Well, thank you. I guess I've always had a taste for old things. You know, when I was a college student, I was reading Middle English and reading lots of, you know, Romantic era poetry. And in order to write the book in this style, or at least to write the sections of the book that are in 18th century English, I just set myself the task of studying some 18th century prose. I read Ben Franklin's autobiography. I read the journals of the Lewis and Clark expedition, which were absolutely fascinating. I read some of John and Abigail Adams's letters to each other so that I could get a real sense for what kind of informal prose of that period sounded like.
Where did you get these names, recompense and temperance? And are those words that were, you know, names that were actually used in that period?
They were. Those kinds of virtue names were very popular. Both Prudence and Temperance, who are sisters of the Winship family, are named somewhat ironically. Prudence isn't always prudent, and Temperance is, you know, frequently opposite of temperate. But Recompense, I gave her that name because I was hoping that she would be a recompense, a kind of repayment for some of what her parents had suffered.
Seems like a lot to put on a child, huh?
Yeah, I guess so.
Now, do you have a section of your book that you can read so that people can get a sense of what this all sounds like?
Absolutely. I'd be glad to. I can read to you from the first chapter from a letter that Prue Winship, the protagonist, is writing far in the future to her adult daughter. And this is explaining some of her misconceptions about Manhattan when she was a child. I kept an eye trained ever on New York to learn what I could of that foreign place. The spire of her largest church rose higher than her trees, and her 3- and 4-story buildings, veritable exaltations of window glass, stood ranked up each morning to reflect the rising sun and the broad dome of sky. Yet the windows never opened, and I could neither see nor imagine families stacked one atop the other within. The bluffs of Clover Hill sang with birds and nickering horses, but no sound but the booming of ship's guns came from across the river. The scents of ripe corn, horse dung, and my father's juniper berries tickled my nose in summer, but though the westerly wind blew fierce, New York had no smell but brine. All the life I could see was of people and horses in the immediate vicinity of the docks. Some other child would have thought nothing of these circumstances. But it was by these signs, fueled, I admit, by a natively dark imagination woefully unchecked by parental intervention, that I came to believe the Isle of Manahatta was, in fact, the city of the dead. Once I had chanced upon this notion, which another might have tossed out, but which I, made nervous by the sights and sounds of the war and by my mother's weird rules governing my ingress and egress, determined could be nothing but the dark truth the world strove to hide from children. Everything I saw across the water added to New York's sepulchral mystery. All those goods that traveled thither were offerings to appease the shades, and it was a grim but necessary duty my father fulfilled when he loaded his barge with libations. That he bore the task so lightly and returned each time with the same blithe expression on his brow, I took for the mark of his good character and valor.
And that's from Brookland, a new novel by Emily Barton, who joins us today. And I'm Rose Arce, filling in for Leonard Lopate. Emily, that was a letter that you read from. Why a letter? Why tell this story so secondhand? Why not just have her tell the story?
Well, you know, I wanted there to be some opportunity for Prue to have her own voice and to tell the story her own way. But also, one of Prue's characteristics is that she can sometimes be looking right at something and not see it. And so it would have made her a difficult protagonist or a difficult speaker for the entire novel. So most of the novel is actually told in a third-person point of view that's closely tied to her, but which allows me to get around some of her short-sightedness.
Did you look at any other letters from that period, from one person to the other, just to see if letters were, you know, written any differently, expressed any differently than speech?
Well, you know, I actually don't know how people spoke in that period. There's not, you know, so much record except for the recorded speeches of political figures and people like that. But the letters certainly had a kind of vibrancy that a lot of published manuscripts lacked, you know, a kind of off-the-cuffness. This was before English spelling was fully codified, so people were able to kind of express themselves even in the way words were spelled, and I wanted to capture some of the sense of that in the letters.
Now, the place that she described, Brookland, seems a pretty chill for a place in the middle of a war. Was it really that calm during the Revolutionary War?
You know, during the period when there was fighting in Brooklyn, Prue would have been a very little girl, like a 3 or 4 year old girl. And for the rest of the war, soldiers were garrisoned in Brooklyn, but there wasn't any fighting that she would have seen. So I think it would have been more like being in an occupied territory than being on a battlefield when she could remember it.
Gerolamin, Skirmerhorn, Remsen, were these really people? We see these streets in Brooklyn. I sometimes wonder, so who is Skirmerhorn?
The Skirmerhorns owned a rope factory, which is what they do in the book. And a lot of those names are names of people who were living in the area, in the town at that period. Very few of them are doing in this book what they actually did in life, but the Skirmerhorn Rope Walk was really their factory.
Was there really a Lucy Van Nordstrom who ran a ferry from Brooklyn to Manhattan?
There was, actually, and he was the only ferryman, and he rowed across the river in a rowboat back and forth all day.
I don't know that most people could really imagine what that must be like, to have Manhattan be this island, this kind of secondary place out there when Brooklyn is the mainland.
It is, you know, it was really fun to imagine. It was also really fun just to imagine Brooklyn as a rural area, because it's so urban now. It's so much a part of the fabric of New York City. And just to kind of stand in my neighborhood and imagine when it was farmland was quite exciting.
Now, were you completely true to the period? Prudence Winship runs a gin distillery in your book. Could a woman really run a gin distillery, or is that some kind of 21st century feminist fantasy that you transported to that period?
You know, I can't say for absolutely certain. It is the case that during the Revolutionary period and the years directly afterward, there was a little bit more of a kind of frontier mentality than a Victorian mentality in the States. So it was actually quite common at that time. For example, if a man died who owned a business, for his wife or all of his remaining children, you know, in a clump, to take the business over. So though I didn't find any specific examples of a woman running a distillery, there are many, many examples of women running businesses during that period.
So it's almost better back then, huh?
It was. It was better, and then it got worse. So
really, that's interesting. Did you find any answers as to why it was better then? Was it the frontier spirit that you were talking about?
Yeah, I think that, you know, probably in the early 19th century, this is just my conjecture, but when people had more money and they'd been away from the threat of war for a long time, there was more time for social graces. And I think that in a period like that, women typically, historically, don't get to shine.
There's a lot of detail in your book about the process of distilling gin. I kept reading it and thinking, you know, people must be reading this book and thinking they want to drink after they read all this. Is this really how you distill gin? Do you know how to distill gin yourself?
I mean, I never have distilled gin, but this is how it's done. I did a lot of research to try to get that process right.
Have you ever watched the process?
No, only in my mind.
Did you want to after?
Oh, desperately.
Now, when you have the letters, when you look at the letters format that you did, was it also hard to put yourself or put words in the mouth of somebody of a different age than you are?
Well, I mean, less important than the fact that she's, you know, a fair number of years older than I am is that she inhabits a different historical period. And so just remembering not just that her day-to-day vocabulary is different, but that her concepts for understanding the world are completely different. For example, Prue's mother suffers from something that nowadays we would call depression. But they didn't have that word. You know, all Prue could know is that she's sad and gloomy most of the time.
But they had gin.
They did, so they could fix it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, but so remembering those kinds of things was a challenge.
Now, Prue begins her story with her childhood during the Revolutionary War. And she talks about how she believed that people went to Manhattan to die. Why Manhattan as a place of death?
I think that when the paragraph that I just read is kind of explaining how Prue, you know, she sees vibrant life around her, and she can't see very much going on across the water in Manhattan. She knows that her mother is sad all the time. She knows that people die all the time because it's the Revolutionary War period. And in addition to the fighting, you know, many children died of childhood diseases. Women died in childbirth. And so I think that being of a gloomy cast of mind, which she is by nature, she just makes this assumption that Manhattan is where the dead go. She doesn't know where else they would go, so that's what she picks.
So Manhattan is a faraway place that people don't go to. So talk about turning the tables there, right? There's some people who live in Manhattan now that might think of Brooklyn as a faraway place they never go.
That was part of the pleasure of doing it.
It's a little payback, right, for all the people that moved to Brooklyn. You described one event in the book that I found pretty amazing. You talked about the East River completely freezing over in the winter of 1782. Mm-hmm. I can't even imagine that. Did that actually happen?
It did happen. It happened on two occasions, and I'm not actually certain what years it was in, but it was in the years directly after the Revolutionary War that it got cold enough that the river froze straight across. In an ordinary cold winter in those days, I mean, I guess the climate must simply have been colder, but in an ordinary cold winter, the river would freeze to about halfway across, and people would drag anything that needed to go across out onto the ice and then ship it over by ferry. But on two occasions, it did freeze completely.
Tell me about the design of the bridge. You know, I think that that's something that people really find fascinating. How true is it to the design of the construction of the real Brooklyn Bridge or attempts to build a Brooklyn Bridge?
In 1811, a bridge was proposed for New York City by a kind of kooky landscape architect named Thomas Pope. And that bridge was called the Flying Pendant Lever Bridge. And he wrote a kind of very persuasive treatise about his idea and left all the plans for it. And these plans are in the New York Public Library. So I had heard about the bridge, just reading about bridges because I'm interested in bridges. And when I went to look it up, I found that this bridge had been largely untouched, that nobody had really written about it. And it's an amazing plan for a bridge. If it had been built, it would have been the world's first cantilevered bridge. So it would have had no supports in the river and would have crossed it in one span. So Thomas Pope's bridge is the bridge that I imagine Prue and her husband Ben building.
Thank you very much. We've been joined by Emily Barton, author of Brooklyn, just out from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.
Thank you so much.
Good luck with your book.
Oh, I really appreciate it. Thank you.